in my own two analyses, I had observed such transformations for me in a very impressive way. I started my own analysis after the traumatic death of my sister when I was 22 years old. At that time, I had a breakdown and I suffered from severe depressive and psychosomatic symptoms and sleep disorders, but also from terrible nightmares that haunted me almost every night. Fortunately, my two analyses did change my depressive and psychosomatic symptoms, but what was at least as important for me subjectively was the change in my dreams, including the manifest dream contents. The nightmares became less frequent. I was hardly in the position of an observer anymore, but actively involved in the dream events. I was less alone in the dream, but accompanied by people close to me, and was more often able to solve the problems and conflicts which arose in the dream. In addition, the dreams were no longer predominantly characterized by fear and death anxiety, but a whole range of emotions emerged towards the end of my second analysis. I will never forget that. I had the only dream of my life from which I woke up because I was laughing out loud.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Marianne Leusinger-Bolibar. Dr. Leusinger-Bolibar is a training analyst at the German Psychoanalytic Association and at the International Psychoanalytic Association. And our conversation today is around her interest in the area of research. Specifically, it's about a forthcoming paper of hers entitled Remembering Dreams, an Indicator for Transformations in Psychoanalysis? And the question mark is actually an important point to mention because, as you'll hear, as I heard, that Marianne has many points of view based on her many decades of work in the field. But in addition to having points of view, she also has a really open mind about things. And that's, a special combination that I certainly enjoyed and learned from. We discussed research that she's conducted on the transformation of manifest dreams over the course of analysis. And she finds that that is a useful indicator of the progress of treatment, and it's associated with symptomatic change. And she reports on a patient who allowed his dreams not only to be monitored in the office, but simultaneously in a sleep lab. So it's a very rich area. That becomes really a jumping off off point for us to consider many aspects of our field and the work. How central is the transference reliving and then remembering, how that's unique to analysis, how important the stability of the analyst's presence is, and how necessary but not sufficient that is what she feels is to maximize therapeutic benefit, the role of approaching veridical past, the actual past as opposed to the hypothesized past, and the seductions of treatments that are simplified, even if they are in the umbrella of analysis. They can be in the spirit of mechanicalness as opposed to uncovering and humility before the depth and riches of the unconscious. And she describes it really with real heart. And she also shares with her own experiences in analysis and how that contributed to her focus on research and the manifest dream. She has a very extensive resume. She won the Mary Sigourney Award in 2016, the Haskell Norman Prize for Excellence in Psychoanalysis in 2017, the Robert Wallerstein Fellowship from 22 to 27, and the IPA's Outstanding Scientific Achievement Award in 2023. Her focus is really on the interdisciplinary dialogue between psychoanalysis and literature, educational sciences, and the neurosciences. There's plenty more to be said, but she says it better than I. So I turn you over now to my conversation with Dr. Marianne Leutzinger-Bolivar. Marianne, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you.
Thank you.
Or more accurately, so good to have you back, because we first had a podcast conversation 5 years ago, even. It's a lifetime ago. It's pre-COVID. And it was about the work that you and your colleagues were doing in terms of engaging and trying to integrate the refugees that were pouring into Germany in years before that. And one of the challenges of having a conversation with you, Marianne, is that your interests in psychoanalysis are so broad that to select one is to ignore others. So instead of doing that, this time, we're going to select two topics that are dear to your heart. The first is dreams, and the second is research. Now, when one mentions research to a group of analysts, two things predictably happen. The first is that they publicly say how important they think that is, that funds should be devoted to it, and it should be published, and it will help us with insurance companies and politicians, etc. But at the same time, many think inwardly, am I glad I don't have to do that? It's so irrelevant to what I do in the office. I'm glad there's somebody interested in it, because I certainly am not. And I think that's because analysts as a group, quite understandably, tend to be people who prize subjectivity, their own and others. They are drawn to affective immediacy, and they really delight in imaginativeness. And when they hear the word research, they think of objectivity and experience distance and evaluation, none of which sort of warms their hearts. Now, you and others have struggled, I think it's fair to say, with this tension, and you've tried to bridge it with what you call clinical psychoanalytic research, which will be what we're going to discuss today. You have a forthcoming article entitled Remembering Dreams, an Indicator for Transformations in Psychoanalysis? And it's about your effort to take manifest dreams as listened to over a trajectory of an analysis and simultaneously measured in a sleep lab and draw conclusions from it. And we're going to consider a patient that you've written about who has allowed his dreams to be used in those two settings for this purpose. And you're also generous enough to add that this comes originally from your own experience in your own analysis, where the changes in your manifest dreams was useful for you and the work. So to start us off, I want to read, to consider the issue of dreams is to consider the issue of remembering. And in the first paragraph of this paper, you write, previously unconscious conflictual fantasies and traumatic experiences are repeated until they are made accessible to therapeutic understanding and can be worked through in the transference relationship. Only in this way do the ghosts of the past lose their pathological power over present thoughts, feelings, and actions, opening the door to sustaining change for the analyst and, which is why remembering can be considered one of the core characteristics of psychoanalysis in contrast to other psychotherapeutic schools. Now, that's a key point. You have italicized that in the paper. Why don't you tell us your thoughts about remembering?
Well, thank you, Harvey, for making the context clear. You know, I'm a passionate clinician, and I know this ambivalence which you just described of colleagues, myself, because I think the ambivalence against universities and science and having to represent psychoanalysis in the mental health systems is as old as psychoanalysis. You know, as for instance, Joel Whitebrook wrote in his beautiful Freud biography, Freud really understood psychoanalysis as a science of the unconscious. He didn't want to create another religion or a belief system. But he, at the same time, he was afraid that psychoanalysis could be swallowed by the world of academia and medicine. This was one reason why he founded the IPA in 1910 as an organization independent of the universities. And I think this had these consequences which you are just describing, that we have the privilege to see our patients outside the clinics and universities and to have all these very intensive emotional experiences with them, which are unique. But at the same time, we, of course, if we think we are a science and we need research in order to be taken seriously by other disciplines, by mental health representatives, and not just have the reputation of being kind of a hidden religion, then I think we are in the struggle which you just described to show to representatives of the non-psychoanalytic world that what we are doing is can be made transparent also to non-believers of the psychoanalysis.
Even the word you use there, to non-believers, it's so easy to lean into that belief system, which is, like you say, borrows from religion. Yeah. And it is very challenging because, as you write and as everyone who's been through it has discovered, there is an experiential quality to analysis that unless and until one has it, it's just an interesting academic way of understanding the mind. But, and this is what came to mind when you brought up remembering. Remembering, when understood in the lay sense or in the non-analytic sense, generally leads people to imagine that what you do in analysis is you talk about your childhood and your mother did this and your father did this. And what people don't appreciate until they've had the experience is that what it's about is about recognizing how the past lives in the present. It's that there is no past, it's all present. And the beauty of remembering is that it's when you've separated out your immediate experience in the present and recognized it as belonging in the past, which then leads to new remembering, that your present gets freed and your future becomes one with new possibility. And that's what's so unique about analysis.
Yes, and that I think that's one of the specificities. And that's why we need kind of to pronounce it, you know, that the danger of being incorporated by other therapeutic schools, I think it's still there, you know, what Freud was afraid of. You know, some modern psychotherapists, they say, well, we have taken up everything which is what is good from psychoanalysis. We also work with life histories, with transference.
Right.
But that's something very different, as you just said. You know, the talking about the learning history as the CBT people too, it's very different from that what Freud meant in his beautiful paper, remembering, repeating,
right,
and going through. because we think that the patients needs to kind of repeat his pathological patterns and unconscious beliefs in the presence of the transference with the analyst until we really, together with him, can understand what that really means. And by understanding the ghost of the past, as you just said, then he is freed, or liberated, you say in English, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Liberated from the atrocities and the disastrous influence of this ghost to the presence of the patient. That's a very specific understanding of remembering.
And genius. I mean, it's a genius discovery. Yeah, yeah. The point that needs to be added to it is in that process that you wrote about and just described, the analyst plays a very particular role, which also distinguishes that work from non-analytic work. The analyst has to be able to recognize and, importantly, tolerate that reliving, even when it puts the analyst in all kinds of awkward states of mind and feelings. The analyst needs to sit with it in service of letting the person relive and then remember.
Absolutely. And I think this is the specificity and the professionality of the analyst. I mean, we have the privilege, in contrast to other therapies, to have a very long own training, to have an own analysis, and really to try to cope with the not understanding and with all the pain and the unbearable, which then comes to the present, comes to the transference relationship. And we know we have to stand it. And by supervision and by our training, by our professionality, I think we more likely can do it than other therapists who don't have this kind of privileged training. And I think we have to show that too.
Yeah, yeah. I like your humility and uncertainty when you say we more likely can do it. It's not that we can or can't, it's that we more likely can, and we never, of course, do it perfectly, which is essential not to do it perfectly or try to.
Oh, yeah, you become very modest if you are a good analyst, I think.
Whether you want to or not, you sort of have to, right? Yeah. So let's talk about this research where you write, for this patient, change in manifest dreams could be regarded as a genuine psychoanalytic outcome criteria, somewhat in contrast to symptom reduction, which are measured with questionnaires in comparative psychotherapy studies. So that's what this paper is about, change in manifest dreams. Tell us how you came to that.
Well, maybe I can be quite personal, being now an elderly analyst woman.
we call it senior analyst, by the
senior
way.
Senior analyst. Oh, sorry. That is my Swiss English, yeah. Well, in fact, the interest in dreams, both latent and the manifest dream content, has a very personal history. In my own two analyses, I had observed such transformations for me in a very impressive way. I started my own analysis after the traumatic death of my sister when I was 22 years old. At that time, I had a breakdown and I suffered from severe depressive and psychosomatic symptoms and sleep disorders, but also from terrible nightmares that haunted me almost every night. Fortunately, my two analyses did change my depressive and psychosomatic symptoms, but what was at least as important for me subjectively was the change in my dreams, including the manifest dream contents. The nightmares became less frequent. I was hardly in the position of an observer anymore, but actively involved in the dream events. I was less alone in the dream, but accompanied by people close to me, and was more often able to solve the problems and conflicts which arose in the dream. In addition, the dream were no longer predominantly characterized by fear and death anxiety, but a whole range of emotions emerged towards the end of my second analysis. I will never forget that. I had the only dream of my life from which I woke up because I was laughing out loud.
Huh.
And my analyst and I found this to be an important indicator that my depressive inner object world, caused in part by this pathological grief reaction, as described by Freud in Mourning and Melancholia, had changed sustainingly. This made such a great impression to me personally that I chose to investigate the dreams of psychoanalysis as part of my scientific qualification, we call it in Germany, the chance to investigate a dream diary of a patient during his long analysis and transcribed analytic session from further for psychoanalysis from the Ulm textbook. And I could find similar findings as the one which I had discovered in my own analysis. And that is a reason why we are taking up these findings now again in the ongoing MODE study. I don't know if you want to talk about it.
You're very generous in sharing these personal details. And you come from a long tradition of people using their own experiences, of course, Freud, and taking those subjective experiences and testing them outside and seeing if it's idiosyncratic to them or whether, in fact, it applies to humankind in general. And you've made important contributions on that basis. Let's talk about the patient that you've presented.
Yes.
It's fascinating for many reasons, especially because you also integrate it with sleep lab research.
Yes.
But tell us a little bit about the patient.
Well, perhaps I first have to say, we all know that the confidentiality problem has been becoming more and more delicate due to the development of the internet. The Quarterly has just a whole issue about this problem. And we had the privilege that this analysis was in the frame of a study, of a large depression study. And I was at that time also director of the Sigmund Freud Institute in Frankfurt. So, of course, we had the ethics committee evaluating our study protocol. And all the patients knew that their psychoanalysis is in a research setting. Of course, we all forgot about the setting, and we just made the analysis. But I think that made it easier to ask the patients if we can also write about.
And just to mention, I have a conversation about the subject of confidentiality with Barbara Stimmel, an analyst in New York who's published on it. And we get into many of the topics within confidentiality that you just mentioned. And it's a rich area. But what you're telling us, and it's important that you are telling us, is that for this work, the patient knew it was for research purposes and signed off on it.
So yes.
Okay. All right.
Oh, I'm curious to listen to this podcast.
She has a wonderful way of thinking about this work.
Oh, I will listen to it. Well, back to Mr. X. He was seeking psychoanalytic help because he suffered from depression since childhood. Many patients in this study had depression since their childhood. But after a family crisis, the depression became so bad that he was unable to do his work as a natural scientist and to leave his darkened room for weeks. He suffered from a range of severe psychosomatic symptoms and serious sleep problems. And he said in the first interviews, "But one of the worst is my nightmares. I often hardly dare to go to sleep because I usually wake up after a short time, bathed in sweat. Dreams like the following one, I was condemned to death and wanted to hang myself in a death cell. And of course, I always wake up in panic." He had terrible nightmares in the first months of psychoanalysis. We then found out in our treatment that these frequent nightmares and his severe depression were linked to traumatic childhood experiences. His mother suffered from a severe alcohol addiction for 12 years of his childhood. And Mr. X remembered terrible scenes of absolute helplessness, powerlessness, also because his father took refuge in work and left the domestic misery to his two children. it was understandable that Mr. Eck therefore had a great fear of closeness and dependence of his love object, which played, of course, a major role in the transference relationship with me from the very beginning of our analysis.
Let me ask you about that, because one of the questions that would come to anyone's mind is when we're following the trajectory of manifest content in a dream, would be, well, it's manifest content, and that is useful because it's easily measurable. And it lends itself to research, but it's also not useful because it's just manifest content. And the more three-dimensional quality of the dream, the meanings in particular, the transference meanings of the dream aren't included in the research, which it may not be possible to because it would introduce so many individual variables that you can't then use it over time. I don't know the answer to that, but that's what I wonder. But what's your thought about relying on the manifest content as opposed to keeping an eye on the transference meanings and presence of the analyst and other objects and the multiplicity of meanings that all these people have in someone's inner life?
Well, allow me to give a kind of an empirical answer.
Go for it, yeah.
Of course, this was, you know, when I made my habilitation, I was a young woman and I was very uncertain, and of course I wanted to be a good analyst, and that's why this question, it was even a taboo to look at the manifest dreams at that time.
Yes.
So that's why I made a great effort in these five single case studies also to investigate the latent dream, the working with dream, with the associations. We made an expert validation. I don't want to go into it. It was quite complicated, time-consuming. But we could really show in these five single case studies that I had two analyses which were running, we said, good enough in the eyes of the analyst, of the patient, of independent researchers. We had two which were such so-so, half-half. And we have one analysis with negative outcome, which was bad for the patient, but good for me, you know, to have a contrast.
Sure.
And we could show that the change in the latent dream, which meant to work analytically in the transference with the dreams, was parallel to the change of the manifest dreams. With now looking to, you know, there is a lot of research now on dreams and sleep research, which is very interesting because they take the dream as a way of a memory reconsolidation. I don't think we should go into that, but just it is very interesting that, the changes of the manifest dreams, it is kind of like a pars pro toto. It gives an insight of a change of the inner world, which is parallel to a change of the inner world by the transference, if we really reach our patients. So I think that doesn't mean that you can kind of paralyze the latent dream. And you know, it's a big issue. But I think we can take the dream, the changes of the manifest dreams. For instance, you know, that the nightmares diminished. We had explained that by psychoanalytic trauma research. I don't know if you want to go into that, but you know, it is an indicator that the long-term consequences of trauma, as we think in psychoanalytic trauma research, one consequence is that the basic trust in a helping other and one's own self-agency breaks down in a traumatic experience. Right. And this is one reason, to make a long story short, why you have nightmares, because this traumatic experience is repeated and repeated and repeated also during the mental activities, during sleep, during the dream. And if the analyst and the patient in the transference situation can make it to have the traumatic situation in the transference and work it through, that the patient makes the experience that he has a holding object, a one that the analyst understands him in his pain, in his suffering, then this is also kept in his memory as an alternative experience to the traumatic experience. And both then is proceeded in the dream. And that is one reason why the nightmares disappear and you have a different kind of processing in the dreams after a period of analysis.
Let me read it as you describe that in the paper. You write, "The manifest dreams of the following years in psychoanalysis show that the regaining of self-agency developed further. The dreamer was more and more actively involved in the dream plot and finally found productive solutions to the conflicts depicted in the dream. In addition, the dreamer was no longer alone, but successively more surrounded by good objects that were helpful to him. We see this as a reflection of the psychoanalytic working through of Mr. X's traumatic experiences in the transference. Due to the stable relationship with the analyst, he is now able to connect to parts of embodied memories in good object relationship experiences, as in with his beloved grandfather, in his inner object world, in contrast to his traumatic experiences in the past." And you write, "This was associated with his emerging from his severe depressive states." And you write that there were analogous changes both in the dream narrated in psychoanalysis and in the laboratory dream from the same period of treatment. Now, that's very powerful, but I have a question for you.
Yes, please.
You write, "We see this as a reflection of the psychoanalytic working through of Mr. X's traumatic experience in the transference due to the stable relationship with the analyst." Now, everyone who is even remotely associated with this work appreciates the central importance of the stable relationship with the analyst. There's no question about that. What there is question about, and hotly debated, as you know, is whether that's sufficient, because it then goes to the question of, so does theory not matter? Or maybe it's the analyst who needs the theory in order to stay stable, but it's the stability that they then can offer the patient that is part of therapeutic action.
Oh, that's
I know it's a hot, but since you write it, let me ask you to flesh that out.
Well, I think it's an absolute central question. And to make a long story short, we have discussed this in our Committee for Clinical Conceptual Epistemical Research, you know. It goes into epistemological questions also. But I'm personally convinced that one is kind of a general variable. If we are not a stable, reliable object, you know, keeping the setting and everything, I think then we can forget everything.
Okay, no question about that.
Yes.
That's the easy one.
But that's not enough.
Okay.
I have written another paper about a third analysis of an polio patient. And I really tried to show by clinical material that, for instance, to understand something about trauma, and have a specific knowledge and a specific theory of trauma and its consequences, it matters in order to be able to understand the patient. It is not enough to be a stable object. It was very important that I had in mind, and that is controversial. We had a big discussion with Peter Fonagy about this issue. It was very important that here in Germany we had so many traumatized patients, and it was very important for them that in psychoanalysis we really cared about the specific idiosyncratic history of trauma, what really happened. Even if we knew that we cannot reconstruct it in a one-to-one sense, but it really was important for the changing of the symptoms and of the inner world of the patients to really approach the historical truth of the trauma. This is just one example that the theories really matter in order to understand the specific.
Just to be clear, the difference of opinion was about the ability to and importance of trying to reconstruct with some real life transference data, I assume, mm-hmm. what actually happened in childhood that was traumatic versus developing a narrative that makes sense to both, but is independent of any objective conclusions.
Yeah, you said it beautifully. It doesn't mean, of course, you always need a transference. It doesn't help if you have an intellectualization of the life.
Right. Right.
It needs this approach to the very, very, I mean, in this patient, it was the onset of polio, which she enacted all the time. She had terrible breakdowns, and the former analyst understood that as a psychotic core, as a psychotischer Kern.
Mm-hmm.
It was an embodied memory, a very specific embodied memory, a memory of the terrible painful onset of the polio when she was 4 years old, which comes out of the blue, just in a certain situation. And it was, I will never forget that because, you know, as Freud already said, I mean, if we are really finding in parentheses the truth, then this has an influence on the symptomatology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the patient was extremely grateful that her terrible breakdowns, which threatens her whole life, she was a manager of a big firm, and her husband wanted to divorce because he couldn't stand these breakdowns anymore, that this disappeared. But it was not an illusion. It was necessary to understand together, and of course, in the transference, this very detailed specificity of her traumatic experience.
You mentioned something in passing twice so far in our conversation today that I want to underline. You mentioned you had two analyses, and you mentioned this patient had three analyses. Now, for those of us, right, you laugh, and many in the field laugh too, and many in the field are sort of used to those references. But I think we are casual about it to our own risk, that many people who are not in the field who are listening to this would reasonably be scratching their head, or even if you are in the field, actually, scratching your head and say, it takes how many analyses to get the job done? Now, again, we live in this world, so we don't see it as the enormous financial and time and personal commitment that it is. But to say that, yeah, you need a couple of them, and these are often not short analyses, what's your reflection on that?
Well, I think it's an important question. Well, in my case, my first analysis was 3.5 years, which was not short, but it was too short. But to be honest, I mean, I was very young at that time. And I think it was good that my analyst at that time let me go, because I was in emerging adulthood, you know? I had to go out to life, to study, to do my job, to find a new lover, which uh-huh. became my husband. And I think to keep people in between 20 and 30 into very, very long analysis, 10 years or something, I personally think that can be a problem. I mean, that are exceptions sometimes if very serious ill people, but the people have to go out to life. They have to find their job, their partners, and so on.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And, you know, it's a danger to take psychoanalysis as a kind of a, how do you say that, a replacement or?
A replacement for life? Is that what you mean?
For life, yeah.
Yeah.
Age, yeah.
Right.
But then, you know, that was with my polio patients, a little bit similar. She had an analysis when she was very young. She really needed it. And it helped her. She was not able to study at that time, and so on. And she was very grateful to this analysis because it helped her to get back to emerging adulthood and develop well. Yeah, but her breakdowns didn't help. And so when she said that due to the first analysis, as you in your podcast with Nancy Mack. William, you know,
yeah.
she also said that she, due to the analysis, she dared to become pregnant. That was right. exactly the right. same with this patient. But then when her children were adolescents and they suffered so much from her breakdowns, you know, it sounded like a psychotic, a different mother.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So she was really in pain. And she made another analysis, which again, she thought helped her with the separation process of her children and so on, but it was not a very long analysis. And then she, concerning with this breakdown, she and her analyst said, well, we probably have to live with it, with these breakdowns. But then when she was 55, her husband threatened to get a divorce. And that was, I mean, this is just an impression for people outside, you know, that it was not, a luxury.
Right. No, we all understand that the whole idea that we're treating worried well is naive. You visit any analyst office and you see real human pain.
Yes, you really see human pain.
Yeah,
and,
yes.
And I mean, of course, from an economic point of view, but you know, the reason why in Germany, the insurance companies still generously pay for psychoanalysis is because we have studies which just show that it is much cheaper to pay for analysis than to have these patients untreated them. Then they go to hospitals and have operations. And
oh, I know. I share your bewilderment. I remember when I was in residency training in the 70s, there was a great deal of data that showed just hiring a psychiatrist to work with internists in the hospital would be so cost effective, because you would be able, even just from a descriptive point of view, being able to diagnose and treat depressions, being able to help in family matters, that would save so much greater medical costs. And even outpatient, like you say, that people who have hypochondriasis, who would go to the emergency room multiple times, if they can bring it into the transference and struggle with it in that way, it saves a fortune. And I've never understood why the people, the insurance companies or the governments don't welcome that. But perhaps that's for another conversation.
Yeah, but it is a pity. And well, you know, that's exactly the reason why I had to do all these outcome studies, because they want to show it again and again, the insurance companies. And you have to give them evidence-based data. That is, and I think, I'm coming from Switzerland, as you know, and their insurance companies practically don't pay anything. I simplify it, but it's very difficult, as in the U.S., yeah?
Yeah. Why do you think it's different for Germany? You know, in our first conversation, our podcast from 5 years ago, you spent a great deal of time talking about how Germany's embrace of the refugees in 2015 was born out of their Holocaust history.
Yes.
And do you think that the generous reimbursement for analysis is related to that?
Oh, that's a long topic. I personally hope so, because as you know, unfortunately, we also have in Germany at the moment, we have, we have this right-wing movement and we have the growing anti-Semitism, which is very concerning. But we still have a public debate where people who have thought about the Holocaust, you know, this kind of painful remembrance in the collective space, we still have these people and we still have this kind of debate here. And these are exactly the same persons who have an appreciation of psychoanalysis, of our concept of the unconscious, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I told you about the institute. I was the director of the Sigmund Freud Institute, you know, Alexander Mitscherli, the founder of this institute. He was a public person showing that psychoanalysis has something to say about national socialism, of the Holocaust, and the long-term consequences of these kind of terrible, unimaginable cruelties and trauma. And I think I hope you are right. I hope that there are still people in Germany, intellectuals. You know, we have a good debate in the newspapers now about this right-wing danger and why do the young people vote for this party, which is terrible. I mean, it's even illegal, you know, but I mean, you know this problem.
Yeah. Let me return to our patient because it stands on its own. And I want to quote from your summary.
Yes.
You write, "The transformations in the dream from the 6 month of therapy and after 3 years are impressive with respect to the growing ability of the dreamer to get involved with others and not needing to retreat into an observing position anymore. Also, his object relations are more mature and related in the later dreams. Neither of the later dreams reported are nightmares in contrast to those at the beginning of therapy. Although no affects are expressed explicitly and thus cannot be rated, the affective atmosphere in the dream from the end of therapy is positively tinged, which one can only assume from his more or less successful problem-solving attempts and his willingness to continue to interact even after being frustrated." That's an important point you make. His willingness to continue to interact even after being frustrated, an important measure of ego development. And you write, "It is also interesting that these changes can be observed in the clinical as well as in the laboratory dreams." Mm-hmm. And to go on, you finish by saying, "Systematic changes in manifest dreams during psychoanalysis can be examined in detail and with good inter-rater reliability. We are interpreting these changes as indicators of psychic transformations of the patient's inner object world. Therefore, studying the changes in manifest dreams in psychoanalysis may be an elaborate, genuinely psychoanalytic approach for investigating processes of transformations in psychoanalysis." And that's what's so special about what you did. It's a genuinely psychoanalytic approach as opposed to the kind of research that scares analysts away. Yes. Because it's not from the spirit of the dyad. It's from somewhere else, or so they imagine.
Yes. Well, it scares me also. I mean, it was so frustrating, for instance, in the depression study, that our main outcome criteria was symptom reduction. And of course, we know as analysts that this is not, I mean, we want that to depress.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, but
it's just not the whole story. Yeah.
It's not the whole story. And that was an attempt to look at the dreams, which I still personally, but also as an analyst, I still think it's a via regia to the unconscious. How you say it in English? A royal road to the unconscious.
The royal road, right, right. Well, let me ask you about that, because nowadays, as you note in the paper, dreams have not taken front center in training, certainly. And instead, the royal road is considered the transference countertransference matrix. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on one obviously doesn't have to choose one or the other, but you noticed the old version of the dream as royal road, and now there's this new version. What's your thought on it?
Well, I think it's not an either or. I personally am sometimes a bit sad. You know, yesterday we had a discussion here in the training in the Frankfurt Psychoanalytic Institute that, you know, that this is, I think, fashions. Or do we say that Zeitgeist?
Mm-hmm.
Analysis?
Yes, Zeitgeist and fashion.
Candidates, sometimes they have a very stereotyped way of using the transference, which I get really sad when I hear that, you know. Just a very schematic, everything what the patient says is kind of transferred to an observation in the clinical situation, which becomes very mechanically.
It doesn't deepen, yeah.
It doesn't deepen, and it's sometimes very stupid. It has nothing to do with remembering, repeating, and working through. You know, individual way of treating the analysants, it gets lost, you know. Yeah. It's kind of a denial to think creatively, and I'm very sad about that because, you know, for me, psychoanalysis is just a wonderful intellectual challenge, and it's a unique clinical experience. But we have to get involved with the patient emotionally, and of course, we have patients who can hardly remember dreams. Yeah. And then sure. we work more with other methods. We don't have this one method. We are living in a wonderful, rich times of pluralism in psychoanalysis. And we are not a religion where we have only one truth. We have different approaches to investigate this dark world of the unconscious, which is and remains very hard to investigate. Yeah. And I mean, these are all simplifications, you know. Then you have you take a transference just as a recipe or something like that. Mm. And I mean, I'm not a historian of psychoanalysis, but my hypothesis is that, you know, this pronunciation of transference and countertransference is already a reaction. I think we had a time in psychoanalysis where maybe we had a mechanical way of working with dreams as well. So this is the pendulum then went right. to, but that is my personal right. hypothesis.
And it raises the question, if dream work used to be dealt with mechanically, yes. and it's replaced by the transference being dealt with mechanically, in either case, it awaits, I hope you're not unsettled by this, someone like yourself to remind us of that and to tolerate the uncertainty and tolerate the ambiguity and creativity to explore both dreams and the transference, countertransference matrix. Yes.
I hope this didn't sound arrogantly. I mean,
not at the slightest. Not at the slightest.
I have such a deep respect of working with the unconscious. I mean, it's a really a hard job we are doing. And of course, when we cannot stand it, our defense is to have any kind of simplifications. And then we become mechanical. That can happen to all of us, to me, myself also. But
no matter what our theory, right?
Yes. And then I know I absolutely need an intervention or a supervision, or I have to make a part of self-analysis. But yeah, I hope it doesn't sound arrogant.
No, Marianne, you begin with your generously sharing of yourself and your journey, and we close with your sharing your humility in the face of the fascinating challenge of this clinical work and of really meeting people as best we can with all our imperfections. Absolutely. As deeply as we can wherever they are.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you for sharing this and for continuing to teach us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for this very inspiring exchange with you, Harvey, and for doing this podcast. I recommend it to my young people, and I think it's a beautiful way of getting to know what psychoanalysts are doing all over the world.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.